Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And on the 365th day of the Trump administration, the scandals keep on coming. Foreign Policy magazine reports that Trump himself was on the phone with Steve Bannon on Tuesday, telling Bannon in real time what questions he should answer and shouldn't answer during his testimony before the House Intelligence Committee in the Russia investigation. If Trump was instructing Bannon to avoid things that would look bad for Trump, that could add to the evidence that Trump has committed obstruction of justice to protect himself from charges. And remember how last week the Wall Street Journal reported that a Trump lawyer paid $130,000 to the porn star Stormy Daniels to keep her quiet about an affair she had with Trump shortly after Melania gave birth to Barron Trump? No one has denied the Wall Street Journal report. Well, today, Mother Jones magazine published an email exchange between Ms. Daniels and a political consultant from a few years later, in which Daniels says Trump once had her spank him with a copy of Forbes magazine that had, wait for it, Trump's own picture on the cover. The political consultant confirmed to Mother Jones that the emails they obtained were authentic. But maybe more important is some Forbes magazine journalism that offers a reality check on the way Trump trumpeted himself at a campaign-style event in Pennsylvania yesterday.
That means more growth, and ultimately it means more jobs. So congratulations. We have created nearly 2.2 million jobs since the election.
But Trump's relationship with the truth is once again called into question, as Forbes is out with a Trump Year One economic scorecard. And while most of the numbers are indeed going in the right direction, Forbes gives us some context, saying there were 2.06 million jobs created last year, which was lower than any of Obama's last 6 years. Forbes also says the 2.5% hourly wage rate growth in Trump's first year was a bit less than 2016's 2.9% when Obama was still president, and mirrored 2015 under Obama. So I alone can fix it. Forbes spanks Trump with those facts. I'm not sure who's on the cover of the current issue. With me now is David Frum, senior editor at The Atlantic, former speechwriter for George W. Bush as president, and author of 9 books, including his new one, Trumpocracy, The Corruption of the American Republic. David, always good to have you on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much.
Let me start with the biggest possible picture that you present us in the book, which is that Trump exists in a context of global authoritarianism being on the rise. Yes?
Exactly. Look, like every journalist in Washington, I was enthralled by the Michael Wolff portrait, and much of it strikes me as essentially true, even if you can't rely on particular details. But those kinds of accounts point us in the wrong direction and get us asking the wrong questions and looking to the wrong remedies. Trump's personality, look, there are a lot of cranky, unpleasant old men in this country. The American political system is set up to keep them out of power. This guy slipped through, and not only did he slip through, but he's ruling with the connivance and the complicity of very powerful forces in this country. My interest in studying Trumpocracy is the system of power, understanding not just Trump alone, but how he sustains in power, how he uses the power, and why that power is of concern, not just as entertainment or shock value, but why it's a direct and pressing concern to the lives of real people.
But I think, as you point out, we saw decades where democracy was expanding throughout the globe, and now we're seeing a period of 10 years or maybe more where democracy is retreating and authoritarianism is rising in more countries. And I think that you see this global authoritarianism being motivated less by ideology than in the past and more by money. Is that right?
That's right. You know, in the spectacular dictators remember from the middle years of the 20th century, you know, the Mussolinis, the Hitlers, the Stalins, the Maos, the Castros, they had a kind of demented idealism to them, for which they committed mass slaughter. Outside the Islamic world, there's very little ideology left. I mean, Putin doesn't believe in anything. Viktor Orban doesn't believe in anything. You know, Turkey's Erdogan pretends to be a fervent Muslim, but he's all about the whatever the Turkish currency equivalent of the Benjamins is. He's stolen probably €1 billion altogether. They become authoritarian to protect the stealing. And that is the great concern about Donald Trump, that Donald Trump is running the least ethical administration in American history on a scale that just staggers the mind. I mean, right now, Donald Trump is receiving payments in the millions of dollars, we don't know how much, from business partners in places like the Philippines, Turkey, the United Arab Emirates. Those are places where he's licensed his name, and he's got partners who write him a check. We don't know whether it's a flat fee. We don't know whether he's getting a percentage. And those partners, in turn, are subject to pressure from their own governments. So the president of the United States ultimately depends on the say-so of Duterte and Erdogan. You know, Donald Trump's business partner in the Philippines is the present Filipino ambassador to the United States. Hmm. Does the guy who signed Donald Trump's check get some attention from Donald Trump? I bet he does.
The first line of your book is, democracy is a work in progress, so is democracy's undoing. So do you see Trump eroding our democracy in a slow drip rather than with broad strokes?
Yeah. I think the analogy I use is it's that when Donald Trump was elected, a lot of people were very upset and frightened, understandably. And there was a lot of talk about, oh my gosh, this is like, you know, Mussolini's march on Rome. That's or worse. But that's not how things work in a big modern bureaucratic state. I keep saying Donald Trump isn't a heart attack. He's gum disease. You can still die of gum disease, but you die because it festers, not because it suddenly seizes some vital organ.
Aren't we supposed to be immune with our laws and our constitution and our unwritten norms? I mean, we're not Hungary. We're not Turkey. We're not the Philippines.
Right. That's true. But the United States has its own complicated history of democracy. I tell a story in the book about what happened after Reconstruction. In the election of 1872, long ancient history, at that time there were about 700,000 people lived in the state of South Carolina, and 100,000 of them cast a vote. Half a century later, 1924, there were now 1.7 million people in the state of South Carolina, 50,000 cast a vote. Now, they had a governor, and they had courts, and they had a state legislature, and they had, if you were white, more or less free speech. But they weren't a democratic system of government. Sometimes democracy expands in the United States. More people are included in decision-making that affects their lives. And at other times, it contracts. It's not a, you know, I was raised on textbooks where it's just up and up and up. You know, Andrew Jackson brings the vote to all white men, regardless of property. Then comes Lincoln, freeing the slaves. Black men get the vote. Then comes the women's suffrage movement. Then 18-year-olds get the vote. Up, 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 up. But it's a much more contested business than this. And we're in a period in the world and in the United States where it's clearly going backwards. If you look at what has happened in the states since 2008, it can't be coincidence that all of the reforms that are proposed to voting make it more difficult to vote, never easier.
Listeners, we can take your calls for David Frum. His new book is Trumpocracy, The Corruption of the American Republic. 212-433-WNYC. You could tell us what you find the most troubling as we reach 1 year after the inauguration of Trump. You could tell us what you like about any of the directions that he set, if you do, or any questions for David Frum about his thinking and his work. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. I think it's important that you see some of the most radical destruction of norms being committed not just by Trump and the Steve Bannons, but by the Republican Congress. How so?
We've had two major pieces of legislation through the Republican Congress. One that failed, the attempt to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, and one that succeeded, the giant tax return reform. In both cases, there were no hearings. In both cases, the votes were cast sometimes with no tally at all of what the effect of the bills would be, of their cost, of their impact on people. In other cases, with the tally being done in the sloppiest possible way and arriving at the last minute. This is also a departure from American norms. And behind it is a deeper problem. What has happened to the Republican Party, I am a registered Republican. I usually vote for Republican candidates. I live in the District of Columbia. If I lived in a regular state, if I lived in New York, I'm sure I would be voting for Republican candidates for governor, for governor and the state assembly and the state senator, state senate. But what has happened in the Republican world is the party has drifted toward policies that can't command a support even among Republicans themselves, and that they're so radical. Demands for drawing back health care coverage and massive tax cuts for very few people, they can't win in the Democratic marketplace. So people like me have been saying for a decade, why don't we adjust these policies so that they are more attractive and more competitive? And we can, we're not going to get, you don't want 100% of the vote. You don't want to deprive people of meaningful choice. But, so we're competitive. So we can win at least half the time and at least half the fair elections. But the attitude that a lot of Republicans are taking is, let's stick with our unpopular ideas and reduce the number of people who are allowed to participate. And that way we can get them through. And that is what has been happening. That's the deal. That is really Trumpocracy at its core, the deal between Republicans in Congress with very unpopular ideas who can't get a mandate and a president who was able to generate a mandate who has no ideas. They need his signature. He needs their protection.
You have an itemized list in the book of underlying causes. And yeah. One is that, and we've heard this before, that the old status quo was ceasing to work for a group of white men who felt that they were being tagged with having privilege, even as they succumbed to disability and drugs and early death. And we all know that story. But then you write, Trump has not kept faith with those voters, but they have kept faith with him. Now, here's another short clip from yesterday's appearance in Pennsylvania that I think might be relevant.
We're putting America back to work, and we're ensuring the forgotten men and women of our country are never, ever forgotten again. Remember? The deplorables. The deplorables. We're all deplorables. Who would have thought that was going to turn into a landslide, right? Who would have thought that was going to turn in?
Never mind that he keeps using that word landslide when he lost the popular vote by 3 million and things like that. But can you talk about both sides of that? He got his cheers there that he was after, but him not keeping faith, in your opinion, with those people, but them keeping faith with him anyway?
One of the great afflictions affecting the Trump voter, down market, non-college Americans, mostly white, mostly male, has been this terrible epidemic of drug addiction. It's just horrifying what is happening in this country. And drug addiction is not the only, but it's one of the most important causes of the decline in life expectancy among non-college whites. That didn't happen during the Great Depression. It didn't happen in Germany during the Great Depression when people were literally starving. Still, life expectancy went up. In peacetime, in advanced countries, life expectancy goes up in good times, bad times, because there are other improvements. The water's getting cleaner, the air is getting cleaner, fewer people work in factories with accidents, that kind of thing. So drugs, so central to Trump's message. He talked about them more than any other candidate, certainly on the Republican side in 2016. The Office of National Drug Control Policy, the central brain of federal drug policy decision-making, doesn't have a chief. And the person Trump has sent over to act as chief of staff, who's the effective boss without a chief, is a 24-year-old Trump campaign worker who falsified his resume. That they don't care about the drug epidemic. They're not going to do anything about it. The reason there is no chief is because the person Trump tried to put in charge of the Office of National Drug Control Policy was a congressman, the first congressman from Pennsylvania to endorse Trump, so that's why he got the job. But what this congressman was also noted for was loosening restrictions on the importing and distribution of opioids in the United States in a way to make it less burdensome to drug companies. He was actively involved in making the problem worse, and he was Trump's first choice.
So
they keep faith with him. But they do keep faith with him.
Because stories like you just cited don't get reported much on Fox News, or what?
Because people don't vote just on issues. They vote on identity. And Trump those things are complicated. And maybe I think a lot of the people who are the Trump voters, they've lost faith. So they're not disappointed when a politician doesn't deliver because they don't really believe the politician is going to deliver in the first place. What they see is Trump involved in these endless battles with people they don't like and who they fear don't like them. And at least he's saying things they want said. And so they forgive him a lot.
Jay in Somerset County, you're on WNYC with David Frum. Hi, Jay.
Yeah, hi. This is a great discussion. I mean, you know, in 1 year, what I have noticed, and you asked this question before, is that, you know, you had this 8 years worth of pent up frustration, a resentment of having this black man in office. And it was the swelling was so much that it has popped, and it has just completely thrown up all over people everywhere, you know, in society, that having this black man in office, and now you have a complete opposite of what happened for 8 years. And all of that frustration is now all over our society, from politics to day-to-day activity. I grew up here. I'm from India. I came here when I was 10 years old. Mm-hmm. And I have never felt the way I feel in the last year and a half, I guess you can say, even before the election. And that resentment that was there, it's shown now. It's shown in the politics. Like you said, you know, nobody cares anymore. All the issues that we talked about in the 90s, and even you can go back into the Reagan era of, you know, just say no, the drug epidemic and all of these things, nobody cares about that anymore. All the sexual scandals that are out there, nobody cares about that anymore. What do they care about? Are you white or are you colored? I hate to say it this way, but I think this is where this presidency has gone, and I don't know if it's ever going to be fixed.
Your resentment is his business model, mm-hmm. is really what you're saying. And David, how much do you agree with that reduction of it?
I agree with quite a lot of it. Let me pick up on the question of how lasting this is. I want to say something alarmist, and then I end Trumpocracy with a chapter called Hope. And these things are often tacked on to books like mine, but this is not a tack on, because I've really, in the process of writing this book, it was a very emotional experience for me that I really sort of sank into some very dark places. And then as I did my research, as I had experiences, I came out of it with something positive, and I'd like to share both. So here's what I think is lasting. The damage the president is doing to the ethical standards of the American government, that's going to be very hard to repair. There are a lot of things that didn't happen, not because they were forbidden. They weren't forbidden. No one ever thought to write down a law that said the president shouldn't take checks from foreign business partners. A president just would... We just assumed the presidency would be filled with honorable people who would never do such a thing. So you didn't have to ban it because... You know, the same way we don't have special laws telling them not to put beans up their nose. Why would they do that?
They wouldn't do it or they would be politically punished if they did, politically punished.
Right. They'd be caught. They would be disclosed somehow. So Donald Trump has lowered those ethical standards, and it will be the work of a general. We'll have to put a lot of these things back into formal law. We're going to need a law that the president must disclose his tax returns. We're going to need a law regulating the business behavior of the president's immediate relatives so that his children don't cash in the way that the Trump children have. Again, we just assumed they wouldn't do it. So that's going to be a big... It's going to be, I think, almost impossible to repair the damage done to America's standing in the world. Donald Trump has not just offended and upset allies, but he's actually changed behavior. I mean, if you're a South Korean and the president of the United States is talking about how I'm prepared to wage a war that will cost hundreds of thousands of lives in your country in order to protect mine, and I'm going to do it while attacking my free trade agreement with you, and while tweeting that the only person who can protect you from North Korean nuclear missiles is the president of China. If you're an intelligent South Korean, you may say, look, I admire the United States, at least not under Donald Trump, more than I admire China. But if it's China that can give me protection, then I need to do business with China, little as I like their system of government. So these are real enduring things. But here's the hope. People like the last caller, I see a level of civic engagement rising in the United States of a kind that, I mean, it's been a long time since we've seen this. And every one of us, I'm sure you've had this experience, who works in the news media, sees it isn't just that people are reading you more, it's that they're reading you differently. They're mm-hmm. paying attention. That question that people who do what you and I do often face, which is, okay, this is very interesting about this storm in some foreign country. What has this got to do with my life? Well, in Puerto Rico, we are seeing what it means for the government to fail. We're, what, 12 hours away from a maybe government shutdown in the United States. And for a lot of people, this is a game. But people, the reason governments exist in democracies, the reason people voluntarily pay taxes, hire people in the public sector, is because they do things that are important and maybe life critical. I think we're seeing an awakening there. And I think we're seeing, in parts of both the right and of the left, people realizing, rediscovering things. You know, I can remember when, for a lot of people on the political left, figures like Edward Snowden were heroes. You know, why does the United States government need secrets? Why does it need to be scanning, you know, scanning the world for threats? You know, if it's enough to protect us from rockets and tanks, why do you need to be protecting us from cyber war? I think a lot of people now understand that danger can come not just in the form of rockets and tanks, but the way the Russians influenced the United States election in 2016, and that the agencies like the FBI and NSA that protect us or try to, they do important work. And on the right, the thing the caller said, I have to say, I think a lot of people, you know, my kind of Republican, I think 3 years ago I'd have listened to that call and said, yeah, you make a point, but you're probably exaggerating. You know, it's not so central. There's not so much prejudice in America. There's not so much ill will toward the ambition of women. I mean, sexual harassment, yeah, it's obviously it's bad and it's a problem. How pervasive can it be, really? And I think when you put and this is where the personality of the president does matter, put a person who just is like a walking embodiment of every bad thing in American society, and not just like in a subtle way, not just with like a, it's like a kind of ambiguous remark, but like just in the greasy fatness of him, all of it
on his sleeve, all the bigotries.
And you think, wow, when I have to look at it close up, it's disgusting. It's cruel. I don't like it.
And it's his business model. Khaled in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with David Frum. Hi, Khaled.
Hi, how's it going, Brent? Thank you for taking my call. If the point of this conversation is to have a more ethical society, more ethical politics in particular, I'm wondering if your guest regrets his role in the Bush administration's lead up to the Iraq War that led to the erosion of our trust in the media and the polarization, which I think might have, which you could argue that led to our current situation now.
I've written a lot about the Iraq War. I'm not asking that anybody be interested in my personal views, but if you go to my website, davidfrum.com, there's a one of the tabs is a button called Second Thoughts, and I've got grouped there a number of articles about things that I've reconsidered. I have very complicated feelings about the Iraq War. You know, I think I support the Iraq War because I believe that there are weapons of mass destruction there. I wouldn't have supported the war if I didn't believe that. But I know that if I were my 50-something self instead of my 40-something self, if I'd been back in time with my values and principles, and if I'd had the information I'd had, I would probably still take that view, because I think President Bush was doing his best to defend the country against what he saw as a genuine threat. And I think, you know, one of the things I really hold, I have complicated feelings about Barack Obama. I admire him as a person. I don't have a lot of agreement with his record. But one of the things I really fault him for was that in 2015-16, he failed to defend the country against the beginnings of this Russian penetration of the American election system. That's the job of the president. I wish they were always right. They're not always right. But the important thing is, do they act in good faith? I believe George Bush acted in good faith.
Let me ask you a different version, in a way, of Khaled's question about Bush. And again, for people who don't know, my guest David Frum served under President Bush, wrote the famous Axis of Evil speech in conjunction with the Iraq War era, the Axis being Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. Bush was toxic to many progressives for what was seen as his own hardcore politics, the way he'd say, you're either with us or against us after 9/11, and detainee policies that got him and Cheney labeled war criminals by a fair amount of the world, plus Bush being a member of the religious right and supporting its agenda in ways his father had not done as president. The point being that we look back on Bush now as someone who upheld the norms of the presidency respectfully and, you know, maybe with too gauzy a lens, but maybe he was really part of the Republican slide toward promoting the culture wars of today that you were just decrying. What would you say about that?
Well, I open the book with a chapter called Pre-Existing Conditions. And one of the things I like to do through the book is I take phrases that people think mean one thing and use them in a slightly different way. I think we've been on a slide toward Trump since the end of the Cold War. I think the presidency as we know it was built to deal with the Cold War. And a lot of our habits around it our deference to the presidency and our assumption of bipartisanship in a lot of important ways, those are Cold War habits. And they began to fade after 1990. And I mark in that first chapter a series of milestones. And I by the way, the Iraq War is there as one of them that I think radicalized a lot of people. And so is the Bush v. Gore decision, which I think shook many on the left's faith in the courts. And there are some things that President Obama did that had the same effect on people on the right. So I think we've been tumbling. It's been a long slide to where we are now. But here, when I'm not asking anybody who listens to me to like George Bush. What I'm asking them to do is to understand, and this is what Trump forces us to do, to understand the difference between your political commitments and your constitutional commitments. There are things that you strongly believe in that other people as strongly disagree with, and both of you are legitimate. You're both, and that the reason we have elections is we get to a point, you know, abortion legal, abortion illegal. There's no, you can't really compromise on that. I mean, you can have some attempts, but basically it's a binary decision. So what we do, that's why we have to, democracy is a peaceful way to arbitrate differences that can't be negotiated. So you know, ultimately we're just going to count, everyone who wants it illegal, put up your hand, everybody wants it legal, put up your hand, and we take a vote, and that's how we decide it. More government at higher cost, less government at lower cost, you know, we can negotiate a little bit, but basically take a vote. That's why we have elections. And you don't have to like the people on the other side, but they have a right to their views. And so long as they play by the rules, if there are more of them, they get their way. Your constitutional commitments are different. So what Bush did in very powerful ways was he challenged a lot of the political commitments of people like the last caller. In 2006, they took away his congressional majority. And in 2008, they removed his party from office. And Barack Obama got into power with a huge congressional majority, and then did a lot of things the opposite way. And people who like George Bush didn't like that. Those are political commitments.
And they lost their majority.
And they, in turn, lost their majority. But then what began to change was what you're not allowed to do is to start disenfranchising people. What you're not allowed to do is to take foreign money and use it to influence. You're not allowed to work with foreign. Those are not.
So Trump is really different.
Trump is different. Even if probably George W. Bush is a lot more right wing in the classical sense than Donald Trump is.
I know you got to go in 1 minute, and I think even we may lose the line in the middle of your next answer if you go too long. Can you give us just 30 seconds on your take on the Russia investigation, and particularly this foreign policy magazine story today that Trump may have been personally directing Bannon in the House Intelligence Committee this week on what he could answer and couldn't answer, maybe obstruction of justice or a piece of that?
You know, Alger Hiss gave the Russians a bunch of useless documents on what was going on inside the Department of Agriculture. This may be the most successful foreign espionage attempt in American history. It should be the biggest scandal. Even what we know already is already one of the biggest scandals in American history. Pay attention, especially what I would direct people to the investigation into the strange flow of money through the National Rifle Association. A lot of that looks like Russian money. And that may explain how some of these Facebook ads were paid for. But more people saw Russian ads in 2016 than voted.
David Frum, his new book is Trumpocracy, The Corruption of the American Republic. David, thank you so much.
Thanks for the airtime.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.